It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about an Icelandic boathouse on Rock Island just off of Door County. That's today in our Curious Wisconsin segment.
First, a look at the ongoing debate over health care coverage in Wisconsin. In a special session vote yesterday, the Assembly voted to hold off dropping thousands of residents off of Badger Care until next year.
And now Governor Walker is looking for federal approval for Wisconsin residents to receive health care subsidies without going through the federal exchanges. They could go straight to insurers themselves, a move that even some Democrats are now supporting.
Joining us now to explain what's going on is Jason Stein. He's the state capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's also the co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with what's happening in the special session. Yesterday, the Assembly voted to delay changes to Badger Care and maintain the status quo for now. The GOP were, as expected, in support, but some Democrats voted for it, too. Why do you think it passed with some bipartisan support?
Well, I think the Democrats were clearly dissatisfied with the proposal as it was brought to them. There is an element of it that it preserves coverage for almost 80,000 patients who otherwise, without the legislation, would lose it on December 31st, lose that state coverage. So that element of it, was enough to win support from some Democrats. The majority of Democrats voted against it because they were dissatisfied that it didn't include it, coverage for people that was for a new group of people, about the same number that was supposed to start on January 1st and will now be delayed until April 1st.
Right, and to that end, Democrats were pushing for an expansion of the Medicaid program that would include this group of people that you're talking about. What were the Democrats' objections to Governor Walker's proposal, and does it have any forward momentum?
Well, I mean, a couple of things here. I mean, one, the Democrats' main objection was that there is federal money available that could be used for 3 months or could be used for a longer period of time to offer that coverage to both groups. And, not only at no cost to the state, but that it, at least in the short term, there would be a savings to the state. The governor's position on the other side is that he feels that in the long term, at least, the federal government can't be counted on to provide money for an expanded Medicaid program.
And what does the Senate seem to signal that they'll be doing with this proposed legislation?
They're supposed to be in on December 19th to take this up. I ran into the Senate Majority Leader this morning in the hallway, and he said that, as far as he knows, there's no one in his caucus objecting to it, no Republicans objecting to it, although they haven't sat down as a group to discuss it yet.
So another threat of all of this is that Governor Walker wants Wisconsin residents to be able to receive health care subsidies, but take them directly to health insurers to sign up for plans in the exchange. And as a step that goes even further, he wants them to be able to take the money and use it for any health plan in Wisconsin. How would those things work?
Okay, right. So we've got two things here. I mean, one, we've been talking about our state coverage, Badger Care Plus. So that's one element, and now we're setting that aside, and we're taking the second element, which is as part of the federal law, there are these online marketplaces called exchanges where you can buy insurance, and not just any insurance plan, but plans that meet certain minimum coverage amounts. Right. So what the governor is proposing is actually two different things. The first thing is that you could go to directly to an insurer that offers a plan on the exchange, and you could buy that plan directly from the insurer. That his argument is that because there are problems with the exchange, people should be able to go and do that directly from insurers. Now, technically, you can do that now. It's allowed under the federal law, but the reality has been that there's been problems with that. And so in some other states like Ohio, Texas, and Florida, the federal government is starting a pilot program to make it easier to buy direct from the insurers, at least for now, while there are problems with the exchanges. And that idea is not as controversial as some other things. I mean, there are people who are, you know, very supportive of the law, that helped to pass the federal law, that say, you know, that's a good stopgap measure to take right now, at least, while there are problems with the exchanges. Then there's another thing that the governor wants to do, and that is more controversial, and that is to let people use these federal subsidies to buy any healthcare plan, not just the healthcare plans that are offered on the exchanges.
And that sounds like that's getting some pushback at the federal level.
Right, right. I mean, there's going to be pushback from supporters of the federal law on that. I mean, it's pretty unlike the other item, which is more modest and is something that the Obama administration is already doing in some other states. It would be much less likely that the Obama administration would approve allowing the use of the subsidies for any plan. The reason, you know, the governor, his reason to ask for it is that he feels, look, that this will provide more choice for consumers. The response from the other side is that, yes, but as part of the federal health care law, the idea is that you provide more coverage to more people, including people who are sick and expensive to cover. And to do that, to kind of offset those costs, the idea of the law has been to bring in younger, healthier people who are less expensive. And that if people are allowed to use subsidies in any plan and not just a select number, that there's a concern that the younger, healthier, cheaper people to insure would be cherry-picked by some plans, and that would make it difficult to financially sustain covering these sicker patients who are in more need of the coverage. So it's a complicated issue, but that's the two perspectives on it, the governor's and the supporters of the law.
So that request from Governor Walker seems like a long shot. The other one seems like that's something that could be evolving.
Yes. I mean, that's something that's already happening in other states where the federal government is trying to make that more of a reality. It's already part of the federal law. So, I mean, you know, there's no reason why it couldn't happen here in Wisconsin. I mean, that doesn't mean that it's going to. The federal government, the Obama administration, has not yet said whether they're willing to include Wisconsin in this group of pilot program states. But that's at least something that is very possible or very plausible to imagine, you know, based on what's being said in the industry right now.
So as far as you know, have the exchanges been getting better for Wisconsin residents? Is it getting easier to sign up?
Our newspaper, not me, but our newspaper has reported that there are more people in Wisconsin signing up through the federal exchanges, that there has been some progress made on that front. But that increase is coming off a very small base. So it's still a limited number of people that have signed up. There's been progress made, but again, that's compared to a situation, you know, in past months in which, you know, almost no one was signing up. So it does not appear that the system is where it needs to be to cover all the people that are being, you know, that are envisioned getting coverage under the law. But there has been some progress documented in recent weeks.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
We've been talking to Jason Stein, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Coming up in just a minute, our guest takes us on a trip to a traditional Icelandic settlement on Rock Island near Door County in our Curious Wisconsin segment. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And it's time for Curious Wisconsin, where we explore the unique and unusual people, places, and events in our state. Today, we'll be visiting Rock Island, where you find an Icelandic great hall and boathouse.
You can see the boathouse from miles away, a huge stone structure that gradually takes the form of a boathouse that, as you approach Door County's Rock Island on the ferry.
It turns out that the 975-acre island most most of which is a state park today, was not only the site of the first European settlement in Door County, but also the private estate of a wealthy inventor who had big plans for it.
Richard Purinton is with us to share the story. He's the author of Thordarson and Rock Island. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Rob and Veronica.
Well, nobody lives on Rock Island today, so why is there all this Icelandic architecture there?
Well, I'm going to have to, I think, interject just a little bit of a disclaimer on that. It's not Icelandic architecture, although it was built by a man of Icelandic nationality, Chester Hjortur Thordarson, or C.H. Thordarson. The building, some of them were designed by a Chicago architect, and I think there's no question that Thordarson himself had a very strong hand in their design. They used native materials, limestone primarily, but they had, for instance, Spanish tile roofs, and they really don't exactly resemble anything in Iceland. So I need to correct that point. And there are several, myths or stories about Rock Island that have been recycled over the years. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to do the book.
Well, I have been to Rock Island and seen this stuff. And regardless of whether they're actually from Iceland, I do remember reading some things about how he brought in artisans from Iceland, I think, to do things like carve runes on the chair in the Great Hall. So you mentioned the Spanish tiles on the roof. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what these structures look like.
They're unlike any other structures in Door County and probably in the rest of the state for that matter. Very impressive. The boathouse is quite bold, stands about 70 feet from water to the peak, approximately 40 feet in width. Very nice proportions, large stone arches. Boats could be brought in on the water level, and then above that was a large hall, a great hall, where there were, I think, social occasions took place there, both family and guests of the Thordarsons. And then Thordarson, from about 1941 through the time of his death, had his books there. That would have been 1945, had books in their cases and furniture that was carved really for his office in Chicago. But he brought those pieces of furniture and his books with the cases, over 10,000 books, to Rock Island. So the carving of the furniture was done by a man named Haldur Einarsson, Icelander, who emigrated to first to Manitoba, then came to Chicago. And that's where Thordarson met him, and he interpreted Norse mythology in his carvings. And I think the two of them got along very well.
What he's building all these buildings on this island. What was Chester Thordarson's plan for this land?
You know, it kind of evolved and changed over time. He bought the property on the island in 1910, the largest piece from a landowner named Rasmus Hansen, who had been logging timber on that property, and then smaller pieces from other people. At the time that he bought property on Rock Island, 1910, there were no other people living there, but there had been a small pioneer community there. Until just after the Civil War, and then people started moving away from Rock Island, I think for better land opportunities, but many of them were fishermen, and Rock Island really did not have a good harbor. So Thordarson first began improving the old pioneer buildings, log cabins and so forth, most of which were over on the eastern side. We call it the East Village, but they were probably pretty well run down at the point that he took over island ownership. So he fixed a number of them up, which enabled he and his family to live in those buildings when they were there, and guests. And then around 1920, roughly, changed, and his emphasis went to the other side of the island, which was much closer to Washington Island and to Jackson Harbor, where there was a good jumping off point to get to Rock Island. It's 1 mile from Jackson Harbor to Rock Island. So from about 1920 through roughly 1931, that was a very busy period for Thordarson in constructing buildings on Rock Island. It was also, I think, a key point in his business life, both in creating, inventing, and in manufacturing electrical products.
So who was this guy? Was he sort of your typical idea of an eccentric millionaire who had these fanciful ideas about what to do with his money?
In some ways, yes. He guarded his money very closely. And a story that he liked to tell, it was recorded first in the American magazine in an interview done with him in 1925, which really, I think, was more revealing than almost anything else written about him. And he said that when he started work in Chicago, and he was in his late teens then, he was making $4 a week, and a couple dollars went to room and board. He put $1 toward buying books, even though he had very little money. And he was pretty much self-made. He had a rudimentary elementary education up through about seventh grade. And then the rest of it was learning by doing and learning by reading. And he was a brilliant individual, so he picked up the electrical engineering aspect and working with motors and windings, and then eventually coming up with his own inventions and patents and then manufacturing them. So that's where he made his money.
Do you look at him as kind of a prototypical immigrant success story?
In some ways, yes. He was very proud, I think, of what he had accomplished. He always was. But he went beyond even the average success story in that although he watched his dollars and pennies very carefully, I don't think from what I've read that wealth in and of itself was something that he was trying to achieve. It was the things that came with that. And Rock Island was really a focus of his energies when he wasn't working on business or, electrical inventions. And develop Rock Island in a way that pleased him, and collecting books. And he did this from, as I mentioned, really prior to 1900. So by 1945, when he died, his library was considered one of the finest in North America, and he himself liked to say in his letters that some of his volumes were not found anywhere, even in the British libraries.
If you visit Rock Island today, what do you see in terms of the preservation of what is there? Is it still pretty well preserved? And what does it feel like just to walk in these unusual buildings and see this stuff firsthand?
Well, I think it's that feeling and questions that evolve from being there and wondering who built this, why did they build it, and what sort of a person was Thordarson. That's what really got me started on doing more research and then eventually writing this book. And I think everyone who visits there has the same question, why in this place, and why, rather extravagant for the day in such a rural setting would he have built these things? Well, I think he just wanted a really comfortable, fine estate. Now, this wasn't lavish like perhaps Rockefeller's or Vanderbilt's. It wasn't finished to that extent. But beautiful buildings and the interest that Thordarson had in botany and nature, he kind of pushed that side of his personality. He had a greenhouse. He raised plants there, some of them quite exotic, and in fact planted, I think, over 4,000 fruit trees, shrubs, and other plants. So it wasn't all, trying to preserve exactly nature as it had been, although I think that was an original plan that he had to preserve it as much as he could. But gradually, he kind of made it over in his own image in some ways.
Is there, in our last few seconds, a hidden gem, something we've got to see that might not be immediately obvious on Rock Island?
Well, I think in addition to the boathouse, which is where the ferry brings you in, and some days I'm operating that ferry.
Nice.
The Pottawatomie Lighthouse, which is the oldest light in northern Lake Michigan, is open. Docents, volunteers will show people through the lighthouse. And the water tower on the east side, which stands kind of alone, it's a stone structure there, because there are no other Pioneer buildings near it. Makes you wonder, why did that get built in that location?
We'll leave it there. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
That's Richard Purinton. He's author of Thorderson in Rock Island, lifelong resident of Door County. As he mentioned, he pilots the Washington County Ferry Line.
If you have a suggestion for Curious Wisconsin, call our hotline. We'd love to hear from you at 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. And let us know what you're curious about, and we'll try to get you some answers.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to an author who's trying to revive the history of the Midwest. He says it's been neglected.
We'll hear about the U.S. Vietnam War veterans who are returning to Vietnam. They're seeking closure and to improve relations between our two countries.
That and the news of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out about the rise of stay-at-home dads and where the trend is coming from. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. There's no doubt the face and makeup of the American family is changing.
One of these changes is the rise of the stay-at-home dad, the father whose role in the family is to stay home with the kids, while in many cases the mother works.
The U.S. Census found that the number of stay-at-home dads more than doubled between 2000 and 2010.
Alex French is with us. He was a stay-at-home dad. He wrote about his experiences in GQ. He is an adjunct professor at New York University. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How you doing today?
Good. So you're not currently a stay-at-home dad, but you were for a while.
I was. I was sort of on and off a couple days a week for about 2.5 years.
And what was your, you're in a similar boat with a lot of people. What was your family situation that led to that happening?
Well, I had been the staff fact checker at GQ for a long time and wanted to strike out on my own as a freelance writer. And it was sort of, we were sort of kind of approaching the tail end of the Great Recession, and my wife was a little uneasy about me leaving my job, so it was sort of a compromise. What we came up with was I would watch my son a couple days a week while I sort of, you know, got my writing career kind of off the ground and moving at a sort of at a viable clip.
Sounds like it felt kind of strange to you at the beginning. What was it like being the one on the playground with a stroller and the bag of snacks?
It was, you know, it was really strange, actually. I had no, I mean, this was going on. I mean, so the recession created quite a few stay-at-home dads. I mean, it really hit sort of male-dominated industries, construction, financial services, things like that, particularly hard. And still, for some reason, we lived in this very sort of peculiar neighborhood in Brooklyn called Park Slope. I think I referred to it in the article as like this, you know, this little hamlet of, you know, upper middle class insanity. You know, there's a lot of very intense parenting going on, and there were quite a few stay-at-home dads. I just never saw any of them. I had no idea that this was something that existed, you know, like in sort of in my, you know, my own sort of very closed off view, I imagined somehow that I was the only dad that stayed at home with his kid a couple days a week. I don't know. It was strange. Yeah. And then I just sort of started seeing them around. Yeah. I got really curious.
Well, for a woman being the stay-at-home mom, there's debates about that, but generally people aren't going to think twice if they see the mom with a kid all day at the park. But you got some reactions even from your parents about you as a stay-at-home dad. Can you talk about the reactions you got?
Yeah, people are, you know, like they double take on the subway. One of the guys I interviewed for the piece recalled for me that he would be in a store, say, in a cashier would say something to him like, "Oh, where's the mama?" You know, like the people who are just not accustomed to seeing sort of like men during daytime hours taking care of a child. And their reactions were sort of either, a little bit startled and sort of surprised, or, there was even sort of like, "Oh, you know, what a great thing you're doing. Like, how heroic." That was strange. I've heard other dads talking about that too. Like, you know, you're not being heroic, you're being a father. You know, it's, you're sort of doing your job. So, yeah, there were some strange reactions. My father in particular sort of treated my, you know, like my time as a stay-at-home dad sort of as this sort of a consolation prize for having some early career hiccups. You know, it took me a while to get my business off the ground, and my dad was sort of unsure about how to treat, you know, unsure about, you know, how to deal with that, how to treat me about in that way. So,
can you paint a picture for us about how big the stay-at-home dad trend has become? I know the New York Times wrote a big piece about it a little while back. The census numbers show that it's doubled in the last, well, in the decade between 2000 and 2010. How widespread is this?
I think it's wide. You know, it's widespread enough that, you know, there is, you know, there is a sort of a magazine now for dads called Kindle. You know, we're seeing sort of more in TV and movies with stay-at-home dads. There was that show Up All Night, which was pretty good, where the sort of plot revolved around the stay-at-home dad. There's a show on A&E, and I think what we're seeing is stay-at-home dads are sort of in this place where it's not quite common. You know what I mean? And it's still a little bit, and people still feel a little bit weird about it, I think.
Did you have fun? Was it fun to be a stay-at-home dad at least some of the time?
Yeah, it really was. You know, I mean, just to put it simply, like, I love my kids. It was great being with them. It was great sort of, you know, hanging around with my son for, you know, hours at a time. Yeah.
One of the things that's kind of in the background of your piece is this, and it's kind of a muted, but it's a sense of fear of seeing other dads who seem to be, to your eye, a little bit emasculated. They don't take time to feed themselves, for instance. One guy you met was just cramming food into his face while his kid was asleep because that was when he could eat, and that freaked you out a little, it sounds like. Is that kind of masculinity rebranding something that most stay-at-home dads struggle with?
You know, I think the way I felt about it was I sort of existed in this place where I was sort of simultaneously like a little bit proud and a little bit defiant and really, really defensive. It's hard to talk about sort of, yeah, I mean, maybe, I mean, it's hard to talk about sort of like rebranding masculinity though, isn't it? I mean, it's such a, I think, part of the difficulty or sort of part of the maybe the stigma that's still attached to stay-at-home dad is just we're just breaking with, you know, like eons of tradition, you know? I mean, it's just the way that things work in the United States is like the man goes out and wins the bread and the woman has food, you know, food on the table. And it was like that for a long time. And, you know, like things have changed and I think people are always sort of resistant or slow to change with it. Maybe.
Is this just, do you think, part of a bigger picture of kind of everybody one way or another is trying to juggle one, maybe two, probably two working parents and taking care of kids, and the answer might be stay-at-home dad, the answer might be grandma and grandpa. There's just, we're taking whatever we got from the toolkit here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line is really just whatever it takes. You know what I mean? Like whatever is right for your family is the right answer. You know, there is no, you know, one of the commenters on the GQ piece online sort of pointed out that, you know, like I probably wasn't cut out for being a stay-at-home dad. You know, like there were things that were more important to me than spending that time, you know, that time with my kids. Even, you know, like I was just very career conscious. Like I was there to sort of start a career. And so I probably wasn't, you know, cut out for it in the same way that, you know, other dads that sort of like make that career move, you know, like decide to leave their job and raise their kid. That's a career decision. So.
Do you see yourself, not yourself, but do you see society as ever going back to that model where if anyone's going to stay home, you know, it's going to be the woman? Or do you think because there have been so many people like you and so many families who have been forced to sort of make it work in different ways that are new, that, you know, we've just sort of changed the way that we raise families and that the way families look?
Yeah, I think it's all changed. And I think that's good. You know, I think the sort of, families sort of improvising and, you know, whoever wants to stay home stays at home. Whoever wants to, you know, earn a living earns a living. I think it's good. I think it's changed.
We have a phrase for this that we've been using, throwing around, stay at home dad. Is that a good phrase? Should it just be dad? Is it important to have a distinct thing to call us?
That's interesting. I never thought about that. I suppose the sort of the acronym that we set up for the article was SAHD, S-A-H-D, which translates to sad. I think the original title of the article was Melancholy and Infinite Sadness. So, I don't know, maybe that name has something, there is a little something weird about stay-at-home dad, it kind of suggests maybe something that's not, 100% truthful or positive. I'm not sure.
One of the interesting things that you paint in your piece is all of the support mechanisms that have grown up around stay-at-home dads. It sounds like there are groups and magazines and organized outings, and there's a lot for people, for dads who are staying home with their kids.
There is. It's incredible, and the guys that are putting these things together are impressive. I spent a lot of time with this guy Lance, who set up the New York City at-home dads group that's on the internet, and it was a business. He's raising his son. His son is now six, but he'd been raising his son, and he started this website, and they've got corporate sponsorship, it's how he makes his living now. I mean, he's a it sounds strange. It's like he's a professional dad. So, yeah.
We're talking about stay-at-home dads with Alex French, former stay-at-home dad, a writer and adjunct professor at New York University.
And we'd love to hear from you about this. Are you a father who stays at home with your children? Have you ever been one part-time? Call in and share your experiences. How does your family handle childcare? What do you think of this new model of the American family? You can call or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about stay-at-home dads with Alex French, freelance writer and adjunct professor at New York University.
And we want to hear from you on this topic. Are you a stay-at-home dad? Have you ever been in your life? And what was that experience like for you? And what do you make of the changing permutations of the American family? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Sean on the line in Wausau. Sean, hi.
Hello.
What's your story?
I'm a stay-at-home dad right now, actually. I'm home with my daughter Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and I work part-time Thursday and Friday. And I love it, actually. My daughter's four, so I get to, see her little personality develop. I get to spend, time with her raising her as opposed to paying somebody else to raise my child for me. And at least right now, it's the best of both worlds for our family.
And any weird reactions to that, or is everybody, pretty much on board and sees it as a normal thing?
I haven't felt any weird reactions. And to be honest, I've got three or four other friends and acquaintances who are stay-at-home dads as well. And, like your guest is saying, I think it's just becoming more common. We looked at the cost of childcare and, what we were making at our jobs, and my wife and I just decided, for what we're paying and what we're getting, you might as well just work part-time and take over the childcare. My wife has a, stable job. She's the main breadwinner. Her job provides the insurance, provides the retirement benefits and stuff. So for the time being, me working part-time and staying home with the kids actually just works out great.
Sean, thanks for sharing your story. And Alex, it's in part the cold, hard financial calculation of you've got a free childcare person there or you're paying for it.
Yeah, Sean's story is actually pretty common. I think now 40% of women are primary breadwinners in their family. That was a story I heard quite a bit, and good for Sean, good for his family. It's great. It sounds like it's working out.
All right, thank you for that call, and let's go next to Rick in Monona. Hi, Rick. Hi.
Hi. I prefer the term Mr. Mom, personally.
The Michael Keaton movie.
Yeah, that's it. I've been a stay-at-home dad since about 10 years now. I started off when my kids were 6 and 8. Now they're 18 and 16. And I'd spent like a long time, I'm an older father, and I spent a long time working in a corporation, and I decided I wanted to see what it was like outside of there, outside of the cubicle. And so my wife went back to work. I came home and started being Mr. Mom, and I found it very rewarding. But one of the things you need to know, and that's it's incredibly challenging too. What I mean is, instead of going to the office and doing the paperwork and memos and that kind of stuff, you're at home vacuuming and washing the clothes. And the biggest challenge for me was cooking supper and having everybody enjoy it. And, you know, there's all these, I almost thought about writing a book one time about Mr. Mom's for Idiots or something like that, because it just took a lot of learning, and it was a real challenge. The other thing that happens is you're also, you don't go to the workplace anymore, and you're not surrounded by all these other people that are your friends and coworkers and stuff. So you really have to develop, I think, a social life, and that can present some challenges, especially when most of the other moms out there are not Mr. Moms, but Mrs. Moms.
Mm-hmm. So, right. So a lot of stuff to contend with, especially, you know, it sounds like you were at the leading edge of stay-at-home dad. So you were kind of doing some of this without a roadmap, and lots of challenges, similar to the things, though, that you came across. Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely correct. Yeah. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, that was, you know, stay-at-home dads were really pretty unheard of, I think.
And Alex, did you face a similar challenge in social connections? I was a stay-at-home dad for some time, and I did some work also from home, so I very rarely saw grown-ups. Did you feel isolated at all?
Yeah, incredibly. I mean, if it was, you know, if it hadn't been for the, you know, the walk I'd take my son on every afternoon, or if we didn't go to the playground, I wouldn't have seen any adults. It was hard. It was definitely hard in that way. And even, you know, even seeing other adults didn't mean that I was talking to them either. I went through this sort of these feelings of, sort of intimidation from some of the stay-at-home moms I'd see at the playground.
Intimidation because they were already their own network,
yeah,
kind of?
They were all there together, and they sort of, you know, like, look at you, you know, kind of like, what are you doing there?
Oh, boy.
You know, maybe a little suspiciously. and it was, you know, it's, they're all there, they're together, they know each other, and you're sort of the outsider.
Social networks. All right. Well, thank you so much, Rick, for that call. And let's go next to Anne, who's joining us in Eau Claire. Hi, Anne.
Hi. My husband was a stay-at-home dad 20 years ago when I was in a very intense graduate school program. And my kids are 23 and 25 now. And I have to admit, I'm kind of jealous of the bond that he was able to form with them at the time. And they had a blast. We lived in Minneapolis, and they did a lot of free things, went to the Como Zoo a lot. They were on first-name basis with Sparky the sea lion. they just had so much fun, but he was definitely the only dad in the neighborhood that stayed at home. And he's a very social person, so I don't think that he really cared what anybody thought. And they have an incredible bond to this day with him, and I think it was because of those 2 years.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Anne. Alex, did you see that at all, that your bond intensified with your kids? And maybe sometimes there was, you know, a little competition between parents about the one who got to stay home and form that bond.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was on and off. I mean, with me and my kids, we were sort of, you know, we're incredibly close now, but you know, then again, I was spending a lot of time with them, and I think they'd sort of get sick of me, and my wife is great with them too. So, yeah, I mean, we're tight now, and I think it has been helpful in sort of creating a great relationship with them.
Thanks for the call, Anne. We'll go now to Jared in Green Bay. Jared, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My personal experience with this is that I have a younger brother who, he and his fiance have talked it over, and he fully intends to just become a stay-at-home dad, so that's pretty much their plan. She's in a much better career path than he is, and what I find kind of, what I what kind of makes me laugh a little bit about this is I wonder if men might actually turn out to be overall those who want to become stay-at-home dads might actually be more okay with it than women might be. You know, for the longest time, women were forced to be stay-at-home moms. They got resentful. You know, they wanted to have, and then now they have this whole have-it-all thing where they're forced to choose or split. I wonder if it might be kind of funny if men would be much more okay with just, you know, forsaking all professional stuff and just doing the one thing.
Because it's a choice in this case, not not a social obligation that the guy is the one to be there.
That's actually a good point, yeah. Also,
We lost you, Jared. But Alex, your thoughts on what Jared had to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the only. I think that's the way that it has to work. I think it's got to be sort of, you know, I think couples really need to sort of get together and figure out what works for them. You know, if somebody's going to stay, I think the conversation has changed to one of us wants to stay at home. You know, from whatever it was to one of us wants to stay at home. I think that's the way it has to work. I don't think it is sort of like a social obligation anymore at all.
And let's go next to Ed. Ed is joining us in Superior. Hi, Ed.
Hey, how's it going today?
Pretty good.
Thanks for taking my call. What I wanted to say is I did this 18 years ago. I was fortunate that I worked for a public employer, and I took advantage of Wisconsin's law at the time, which allowed me to take 6 weeks off when my child was born, and still continue to receive take vacation time and other time that I had on the books in order to be able to stay home. And you know, that was probably, I did it with both of my sons. One is 14 now, the other is 18, and that was a tremendous thing. You form better bonds with your children. And realistically, I think that should happen to every parent. I know they do that in Scandinavia where, you know, parents are allowed quite a significant family leave from their jobs and things like that to be able to stay home with their children. You know, you have to wonder these days. We have a lot of problems with kids. I mean, my line of work is police work, so I see kids that are problems all the time. And, you know, I think that having a better bond with the parents is, I think, a very, very important thing for society that we neglect.
All right. Thank you so much, Ed. And Ed talking about, again, the bonds that can develop and why this is important for families in general, not just moms and kids.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything Ed just said.
So where do you see this going, Alex, stay-at-home dads? We're theoretically coming out of the recession that created a lot of stay-at-home dads, but do you think they're going to go away anytime soon?
Not. I think this is wide open now. I think you're going to see, you know, I think this is sort of like the first, sort of the, just the sort of the tip of the spear with stay-at-home dads. I think, you know, the resources are going to get better. Guys are going to get smarter about this. You know, people are going to, you know, people who sort of, this ends up sort of as a career alternative for them. I think they're going to, you know, I think what we're going to see is we're going to see a generation of guys who get really good at parenting too, who attack parenting in the way that, you know, some of the ways that, you know, some of the guys that I talked to, the way that they were doing it was it literally became their job. It became what they, you know, what they were all about. I think, you know, we're sort of just at the beginning of this.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Alex French, freelance writer and adjunct professor at New York University.
Coming up, we'll talk to a former chancellor of UW-Madison about the trouble the UW system has in retaining talented professors.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.